Good afternoon. The Labor Industry Veterans Military Affairs Finance Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this hybrid meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on House Public Information TV, which is available on the website. As is custom with this committee, we'll please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mr. Petrie, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Present.
Chair Eklund, present. Representative Zhang. Representative Detmer.
Okay. Somebody was whispering in my ear.
Representative Detmer.
I'm here.
Here. Representative McDonald. Representative Byrd.
Present.
Representative Byrd, present. Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Bliss, present. Representative Edelson. Representative Edelson, present. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Frederick, present. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Greenman, present. Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Nelson, present. Representative Poston. Oh, Representative Poston, present.
Sorry, couldn't hear you.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Raleigh, present. Representative Sundin.
Present.
Representative Sundin, present.
Quorum is present. Members, one thing about this committee room, we got to make sure with the people on hybrid that aren't here, speak into the microphone, because otherwise they won't hear you. So pull the microphones down in front of you when you talk. Representative Nelson, you care to move the minutes from March 30th, 2022?
If I must, I'll move the minutes, approval of the minutes to March 30th, 2022.
Is there any questions, additions, or deletions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. Minutes are adopted. Members, what process we'll look today is I will introduce our Labor and Industry Omnibus Bill. Nonpartisan staff will walk through the appropriations and the policy aspects of the bill, and we will receive public testimony on the bill. Finally, we will consider the DE, the A22-0402 amendment, the two amendments to the Omnibus Bill. We will vote out of, and the two amendments to the Omnibus Bill. We will vote the bill out of committee. Now, members, since we are considering our Omnibus Bill, I will now turn the gavel over to Chair Sundin, who's going to take over. Vice Chair Zhang may be joining us shortly. So.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. Would you like to move your bill? Okay, members, in front of us today we have House File 4177 from Chair Eklund, our committee's omnibus Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Bill. Welcome, Chair Eklund. Please move your bill and your DE1A22-0402 amendment and explain the bill and your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move the DE1A22-0402, and this bill should be referred to Ways and Means. And Mr. Chair, before we start, I think I'll have nonpartisan staff walk through the bill first. So I believe we have Ms. Roberts to do the spreadsheet and Ms. James to do the bill itself, the DE.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Roberts. Members, we will now hear from the nonpartisan staff. Ms. Roberts, go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Helen Roberts from the House Fiscal Staff. Can you see the screen that I just shared?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to walk through the spreadsheet quickly. The first agency that has a change item is the Bureau of Mediation Services, and you can see on line six, there's $400,000 in additional funding for the Public Employee Relations Board, also known as the PERB, and this is from House File 3395, Representative Nelson's bill. The next agency, starting on line nine, is the Department of Labor and Industry. The first group of change items are all the general fund change items. On line 10, you'll see $150,000 for the combative sports health and safety improvements. On line 11, $196,000 for expanding and strengthening the Fair Labor Standards Act for agriculture and food processing workers. And this is from House File 4314, Representative Hansen's bill. On line 12, there is $747,000 for the youth skills training, grants, and administration. Then on line 13, $1 million for the logger safety grant program. And finally, on line 14, this is a general fund transfer for to the construction codes fund related to the building and trade license fee holiday of $3.357 million in fiscal year 23, and then an additional $4.45 million in fiscal year 24. And this is from House File 4647, Representative Berg's bill. So the total general fund change on line 15 is $5.45 million. Then moving down to line 17, the next group of items are the non-general fund changes. First on line 17, $145,000 from the construction code fund for the commercial energy code improvements. On line 18, $160,000 for the safe housing for the elderly and vulnerable adults provisions, again from the construction code fund. On line 19, you'll see the combative sports health and safety improvements. This is from the statutory special revenue fund appropriation, and that's $14,000. On line 20, the next two items are from the Workforce Development Fund, so you'll see $1.375 million, and that's for increasing equity in apprenticeship. Then also on line 21, prevailing wage education and compliance, $1.758 million in fiscal year 23. And so the total non general fund change items are $3.452 million. Moving down to line 24, here you'll see the total direct appropriations, the general fund and workforce development fund of $8.583 million. And that is the number that you'll actually see in the bill language. The final agency under this jurisdiction is the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. They have two change items from the Workers' Compensation Fund. The first is an operating adjustment of $200,000 per year, and then a one-time funding request of $100,000 for rulemaking related to campus. And so the total change for the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals on line 29 is $300,000. The last page of the spreadsheet just shows the total expenditures by fund. You'll see on line 32, the total general fund expenditure change is $5.85 million. On line 37, the total for all funds is $9.6 million. And then there are some revenue changes. On line 40, you'll see the general fund revenue change of $16,000 related to the prevailing wage education and compliance provisions. And the total revenue changes for all funds on line 45 is $311,000. And then finally, at the last line of the spreadsheet, you'll see the net general fund impact, the combination of expenditures and revenues of $5.834 million. And I will stop sharing unless people have questions on the spreadsheet.
Are there any questions for Ms. Roberts on regarding the spreadsheet? Thank you. Members, now we're going to hear from our nonpartisan House research staff, who will present the policy aspects of the DE1 amendment for House File 4177. Welcome, Ms. James.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am Marta James from House Research, and I will go over the policy sections now. So for the author's amendment, and just so everyone knows, I am working off of the page and lines from the A22-0402. So starting with Article 1 on page 1, line 3, again, that is the appropriations that Helen just covered, and you can see her fiscal spreadsheet for more details on that. Article 2 starts on page 4, line 3. That is the labor and industry policy and technical provisions. There are several provisions in this, so I will just cover them very briefly for you. Sections 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6, 8, and 9 all create the Division of Apprenticeship, and that will be separate from the Division of Labor Standards. So these sections remove the obsolete language for that. Section 3 relates to Section 11, which Section 11 prohibits restrictive franchise agreements and then also requires amendment of current restrictive agreements. So Section 3 allows the commissioner to issue compliance orders for that section. Moving then to Section 7, that's on page 6, line 9, that modifies the LEAP grants to focus on targeted groups. Section 10 on page 7, line 9, prohibits non-competes and employment contracts unless the exception applies. Then section 12 on page 10, starting at line 1, that removes the contractor licensing fees for a two-year period, what's been referred to as the fee holiday. Section 13 on page 11, line 9, designates assisted living facilities as state licensed facilities under the state building code. And I should mention, a lot of these provisions do come from other House files, and I'm happy to point those out if anyone has questions on that. Then moving back to section 14, this is directs the DLI commissioner to adopt model commercial energy code. Section 15 modifies window cleaning safety building code requirements, and that's for new buildings and alterations. That's an example of a bill that came from House File 165, a Representative Detmer bill that was modified in committee. Section 16 reduces the valuation and fee schedule for building permit fees for the specified period. Section 17 then on page 16, line 3, exempts load control equipment owned and maintained by a utility company from the inspection requirements if the certain requirements in that language are met. Again, that's an example of one that came from House File 215 as amended in committee. And that was a Representative Lisle-Lagarde bill. Finally, Section 18 clarifies the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council bill effective dates. So that was Article 2 very briefly. Then turning to Article 3, which starts on page 17 and goes to page 19. This is the OSHA penalty conformance. And so these sections increase the OSHA penalties to conform to federal law. That was a provision from House File 4177. Again, just a very high-level summary of these provisions for you. Article 4 on page 19 contains the Fair Labor Standards for Agricultural and Food Processing Workers. This language was from House File 4314, which was Representative Hansen bill. This language contains many additions and modifications to fair labor standards for agricultural and food processing workers. And some of the provisions impacted are the migrant labor law, the packing house workers' bill of rights, as well as the recruitment and food processing. Article 5 is the combative sports article. That starts on page 26. Line 24, and those sections make a variety of technical changes to the combative sports licensing system. Article 6 covers the Public Employment Relations Board. This starts on page 37 and contains two provisions, or four sections and two main provisions, modifying the effective date for the PERB, as well as how data used by the PERB is treated. And that language came from House File 3395, the first engrossment of Representative Nelson bill. Finally, Article 7 on page 39, starting at line 1, provides for refinery safety requirements, including, among other things, that there is experience with a registered apprenticeship program in the applicable trade for a certain percentage of refinery workers. That language is from House File 984, the second engrossment with an amendment, and that was Representative Liz Legarde's bill. And those are the article policy provisions for the omnibus, and I'm also happy to answer any questions.
Okay, stay handy, Ms. James. Appreciate your input. We have a list of testifiers today. I'll call the names. You can identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony. First up, we have Roslyn Roberts, Robertson. Does the author want to give an overview at this point?
Real quickly, Mr. Chair, before the commissioner comes on board. And so thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This DE amendment that we're looking at is a result of work that we have done as a committee this year. We have had some interesting conversations, sometimes raucous debates on several of these proposals. Is there everything in this bill that the chair wanted? Not at all. But I believe that we're putting forward a good bill that looks out for the working men and women of the state. I've made it clear throughout the session that this committee is going to make sure that our working men and women, our veterans, and our National Guard members are the focus and scope of this committee. I appreciate the input that I've received from all of the committee members, and I look forward to working with you as we move this legislation forward to Ways and Means and to a future conference committee. At this time, I will turn it over to testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Robertson. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 4177 as amended. For the record, my name is Roslyn Robertson, and I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. I'm incredibly pleased that House File 4177, as amended, include the agency's supplemental budget priorities. These investments and policy changes will enable the agency to better meet the needs of its stakeholders. Regarding the A1 author's amendment, a veteran liaison coordinator position within the Registered Apprenticeship Unit would enable the agency to better support veterans in the trades and increase veteran participation in registered apprenticeship. The agricultural worker wellness provisions, creating an ombudsperson and an agricultural worker wellness committee were originally a deed provision within their budget. We look forward to working with the committee on this proposal. Regarding the A3 amendment to provide an exemption from elevator contractor licensure for work on conveyors, platform lifts, and dock levelers, the department prefers this approach to provide an exemption from licensing for work on certain elevator equipment to the bill as introduced. We've been in communication with stakeholders, and again, we look forward to agreement by all parties. Turning to the provisions in the Delete All Amendment to House File 4177, I would like to thank the committee for the inclusion of the agency budget and policy priorities. The operating and LEAP grant increase in the bill will grow registered apprenticeship in Minnesota. It establishes a separate director for apprenticeship, and it will train and reskill the state's workforce. Minnesota has experienced growth in the apprenticeship program over the last several decades, and this growth will continue. As of today, we have over 10,000 registered apprentices in 8 industries. There are 194 active apprenticeship sponsors and more than 2,300 participating employers. Those numbers will continue to grow, given the demand for skilled workers and also as we prepare for the expanded infrastructure projects coming to Minnesota. Due to this demand and growth in the labor standards unit, apprenticeship needs its own director to meet its statutory obligations. Presently, a single individual directs both the registered apprenticeship unit and the labor standards program. DLI currently receive $100,000 from the Workforce Development Fund each year for LEAP to distribute in grants to up to 5 organizations for amounts ranging from $12,000 to $30,000 per year. Current grantees have expressed that the funding is insufficient to establish a meaningful program. The funding is low and has been low for quite some time, and there's no way the community-based organizations that we work with can fulfill the statutory intent. An increase in grant funding to $1 million will enable more community-based and nonprofit organizations and tribal governments to implement services to improve the participation, the recruitment, the retention, and the completion of women, people of color, and indigenous people in registered apprenticeship. We thank you for including this funding in registered apprenticeship. I'm also grateful that the bill includes the agency request for $1.758 million in prevailing wage enforcement. Prevailing wage law exists in Minnesota to ensure projects funded with public money are constructed and maintained by the best means and highest quality of labor reasonably available, and that persons working on public works are compensated according to the real value of the service they perform. The increase will fully fund the current prevailing wage staff employed by the department, as well as support additional staff necessary to provide prevailing wage education and enforcement. While not an agency proposal, the $750,000 in additional funding for logger safety grants will be welcomed by the industry. The agency awarded the full $1 million appropriated for logger safety grants last session with 61 applicants. The funding enabled those employers to purchase and maintain recommended safety equipment and invest in training to reduce the risk to their employees. The funding increase for the Youth Skill Training Program will enable the agency to support additional partnerships among school districts, employers, and community-based organizations to offer safe, healthy, and meaningful work experiences to 16 and 17-year-old student learners. By growing youth skill training, more student learners will be better equipped to enter the workforce, and more employers will have the skilled workers they need. I also appreciate that the bill provides a general fund appropriation to transfer to the construction code fund to make up for the revenue loss due to the license fee holiday included in this bill. This 2-year fee holiday for building and construction trade professional licenses will provide economic relief to approximately 87,000 new and existing trade licensees. I appreciate that House File 4177 provide the agency regulatory oversight of assisted living facilities and assisted living with dementia care facilities licensed by the Department of Health. This proposal will enable the agency to provide construction code reviews and inspections statewide to ensure these facilities designed for the elderly and vulnerable adults meet the minimum safety standards. I'm also grateful that the bill addresses the issue of increasing greenhouse gas emission in commercial building. The bill institutes an adoption framework for the statewide commercial building code to ensure all new commercial and large multifamily construction is net zero by 2036. Since 2005, greenhouse gas emissions in commercial building sectors have increased by 15%. Partially driven by higher heating and cooling demands, and also by a changing climate. The state is running out of time to make meaningful progress on addressing climate change, and this initiative is an important component to achieving greenhouse gas reduction goals. I appreciate the bill includes two fixes in Article 2. The construction code and licensing fee reduction language correction in Section 16, and the addition of effective dates to the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council recommendations that became law earlier this session in Section 18. Moving to Article 3, I'm pleased the House File 4177 addresses OSHA federal penalty conformity. To be at least as effective as federal OSHA, Minnesota OSHA needs to align its penalties that it issues to employers that fail to provide safe and healthy workplaces for their workers with federal penalties. Conformity would ensure continued federal funding and would encourage employers to continue to take workplace safety and health violations more seriously and to do all that they can to keep their workers safe. I appreciate that Article 4 includes the agency proposal for fair labor standards for agricultural and food processing workers, as recommended by the Committee for Safety, Health, and Well-being of Agricultural and Food Processing Workers. The provision will expand workplace protection and build awareness of workers' rights for these employees. I'm also grateful House File 4177 includes the recommended funding for the Office of Combative Sports, along with the policy changes in Article 5, aimed at better protecting combatant safety and health. These proposed changes close regulatory loopholes, improve event security, clarify pre-licensure requirements for combatants, referees, judges, timekeepers, and ringside physicians, and it establishes a statutory procedure for challenging the outcome of a combative sport contest. These changes are needed as Minnesota plays an important and growing role in combative sports regulations. Finally, I appreciate inclusion of the language in Article 7 of House File 4177 to require all refinery contractors to participate in registered apprenticeship for work in the construction and maintenance of oil refineries, as it will ensure workers have access to skills and training needed to perform these jobs safely. I thank the committee for your time, and I'm happy to respond to questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Robertson. Please stick around. I'm sure there will be questions. Next up, we have Melissa Heising.
Stay close. Good afternoon. Whoa. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. These microphones are more sensitive here, I guess. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Melissa Heising, and I am Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, the state's labor federation of more than 1,000 local unions who represent more than 300,000 working people throughout our state. I'm here to express our support of House File 4177 as amended and to highlight a few of the reasons we think this is a good bill. Increasing compliance with existing labor standards is always a priority for labor. That is why we're excited to see $1.7 million in increased funding for prevailing wage education and compliance. Especially with massive federal funding for infrastructure coming to our state, it is important to ensure that funding creates jobs with family-sustaining wages. We're also happy to see ongoing funding for the Public Employee Relations Board so that agency can do the work of helping to resolve labor management disputes in the public sector. Ensuring workplace safety for all Minnesotans is critical. That's why we're glad to see OSHA federal penalty conformity with indexing to inflation. Our state penalties have not been adjusted for over 20 years and are the third lowest in the country. Conformity will ensure that we maintain our state program and federal funding, as well as deter workplace health and safety violations by employers. We're also pleased to see the oil refinery safety provisions in the bill. Refineries can be dangerous places to work, and they can put local communities at risk if they're not properly maintained. The refinery safety bill will keep refinery workers and nearby communities safe by requiring the use of a skilled workforce. I also want to note that it's my understanding that the window cleaning safety provisions in the bill have been agreed to by the Window Anchors Construction Advisory Council with the participation of window cleaners. It's good to see legislation developed in consultation with the workers who would be directly affected. And finally, we want to thank you for not including the wage theft provisions heard earlier in session that would roll back key elements of the 2019 wage theft law that ensure workers know what they are supposed to be paid and that penalties are adequate to deter violations of the law. And with that, Mr. Chair, thank you. I just want to encourage members to vote yes on this bill.
Thank you. Next up, we have Tony Poole from Pipefitters Local 455.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tony Poole. I'm the business manager for the St. Paul and Mankato Pipefitters Local 455, representing over 1,600 construction trade professionals in the steam fitting and pipe fitting crafts. Our jurisdiction includes both the Flint Hills and Marathon Petroleum refineries. I'm here today to testify in favor of Article 7 of House File 4177, Chairman Eklund's omnibus bill. Article 7 is an amended, improved version of Rep. Lissegaard's House File 984 dealing with refinery safety. Article 7 stands for the simple yet powerful public policy statement that oil refineries, when they hire outside contractors for maintenance and improvement work, should hire only contractors that employ workers who have been trained via a registered apprenticeship program. At core, this bill recognizes that registered apprenticeship programs are the gold standard of workforce training, producing construction professionals who lead the industry in skill and safety practices. Over the years, I've been encouraged by the legislature's increasing recognition of apprenticeship training's value to the construction trades and other fields. If you look at the bill introductions this year, you can see multiple bills introduced by Republicans and Democrats that support apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship training in multiple fields. The pipe trades have been proud to host hundreds of legislators in recent times at our joint apprenticeship training centers, where our partnership with our contractors is clearly demonstrated. This bill is only a logical extension of that recognition. There are a couple of misconceptions that I do want to clear up as the committee considers this provision. One, the registered apprenticeship requirement is not some sort of fencing of trade union work. Apprenticeship programs may be developed and registered by any contractor, union or non-union. Many non-union contractors have registered apprenticeship programs. In fact, the ABC of Minnesota and North Dakota, which has testified against this bill on many occasions, has its own registered apprenticeship program. Second, this bill isn't new, unique, or untested. The legislation borrows heavily from jurisdictions that have successfully implemented skilled and safe legislation. Some of the largest refineries in America operate under skilled and safe workforce laws. Despite some of the same sky-is-falling opposition, those refineries are still operating today. Furthermore, skilled and safe legislation has been a bipartisan effort. In Ohio, their skilled and safe legislation is chief authored by a Republican. Similarly, I'm encouraged by the bipartisan and bicameral support here in Minnesota. Members of the committee will recall that a floor amendment to strip this provision out of last year's omnibus bill failed on a bipartisan vote. In the Senate, a floor amendment adding this legislation was successfully added to the omnibus bill on a bipartisan vote. While the legislation didn't cross the finish line last year, the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association is optimistic that this legislation will become law in 2022. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Poole. Next up, we have John Burkhoff, Director of the Academic Education and Chief Administrative Officer of the Finishing Trades Institute of the Upper Midwest.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House File 4177. My name is John Burkhoff, and I'm the Director of Academic Education at the Finishing Trades Institute of the Upper Midwest, an accredited apprenticeship college located in Little Canada, Minnesota. I'm here today to thank the committee for including the governor's recommendation to increase funding for registered apprenticeships in Minnesota. Many people may not know that the Finishing Trades Institute of the Upper Midwest is a unique collaboration. We are a partnership between management and labor coming together to provide training and education to the workforce. We support the expansion and increased funding of the Labor Education Advancement Grant Program, or LEAP, funding in Governor Wall's budget proposal. These new dollars would provide apprenticeship opportunities and growth for women, underserved populations, and employers throughout Minnesota. We further support the expansion to include nonprofit organizations such as ourselves. The FTI of the Upper Midwest has a proven track record of providing equitable learning and employment opportunities. We have made significant gains in diversity in recent years. Minnesota's Department of Labor and Industry reporting recently reflected that 47.6% of FTI of the Upper Midwest apprentices are women and/or people of color. This draws attention to the school's unmatched success at providing equity to future career candidates and its ability to have a sizable impact on the underserved communities in the Twin Cities, Greater Minnesota, and Western Wisconsin. Additionally, our work supports social progress by solidifying and expanding community partnerships and driving economic growth. This aligns with the primary goal of creating a sustained pipeline of middle school and high school students, graduates, and other young adult candidates for construction and manufacturing registered apprenticeship programs. Our apprenticeship programs now have completion rates of more than 80% and employment rates of 100%. Apprentices get paid to learn their trade and graduate from our college program debt-free. The school's focus is to ensure that every one of our students is placed into jobs with their industry-leading employers, committed to providing our graduates with jobs that will continue to guide them on their path to a rewarding and enjoyable career. In closing, we are confident that the increase in funding and the addition of a director of apprenticeship will result in the long-term strategic growth of a diverse and robust Minnesota registered apprenticeship system, in turn providing employers with an inclusive workforce that they need to be profitable. This diverse workforce will bring new perspectives, a wider talent pool, more innovation, better employee performance, and yes, increase profits. Together, we must ensure equitable opportunities in apprenticeship and provide the structure and support required for all apprentices to be successful. Thank you again, Mr. Chair, and committee members for your commitment to registered apprenticeship and for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Burkhoff. Up next is Mark Nelson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mark Nelson. I'm an international boxing referee from St. Paul. Thank you for the opportunity to support the combative sports appropriation and policy provisions in House File 4177 as amended. I've had the privilege to officiate close to 3,000 amateur and nearly 850 professional boxing matches that include over 110 world title fights throughout the United States and 18 different countries. I know firsthand how important it is to have policies in place that are consistent with other jurisdictions, primarily for the welfare and the safety of the boxers and their families. Being a professional referee for 30 years, I was very happy to learn of the potential changes, especially since Minnesota is becoming a hotbed for boxing. From my perspective, the proposed changes are beneficial and necessary, not only for the safety and welfare of the fighters, but also to ensure that Minnesota's combative sports regulations are consistent with other states and jurisdictions. A majority of people involved are the same group of individuals traveling back and forth from state to state, promoting fights in countries alike. The changes will help assure that the state gets the appropriate fees from the promoters and prevent unnecessary time and cost to the commission associated with the challenge process. With regard to safety and welfare of the boxers, it's important to note that blood work, physicals, and pregnancy tests are mandatory to prevent unnecessary harm. The request to obtain results from amateur boxers will help monitor their records, experience, and injuries. This is currently being done in several other states and should be done here as well. Regarding challenges of a contest, currently, almost any type of grievance can be submitted. The work involved to have individuals review and notify all parties with the documented communication and then have each of them review and reply with documented responses is very time-consuming and costly. The three specific alleged reasons for challenges should be put into place so valuable resources aren't wasted. The boxing community is a close-knit family. All the coaches, officials, including judges and timekeepers, started in the amateurs volunteering their time. Regardless of the type of event, whether it's a small club show or a large nationally televised event here in Minnesota, we are fully invested and truly care about the outcome and well-being of everyone involved. I'm very confident in saying that we all hope this amended bill can move forward so our Minnesota combative sports can continue to operate safely and skillfully. Thank you for your time today.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Nelson. Up next, we have Amy Lord from Independent School District 728, I think.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I would like to thank you for including the Youth Skills Training Program funding in this bill. My name is Amy Lord, and I am the Career and Technical Education Coordinator at ISD 728. That's Elk River Rogers Zimmerman area. I'm happy to speak to you today in support of increasing the funding for the Youth Skills Training Program. As a grant recipient, I can speak firsthand to the benefits of this program. I've identified three key areas that I've seen the largest benefit in our communities. That includes implementing our internship apprenticeship program for our high school students, increasing partnerships in general, and then also addressing local workforce shortages. So first, our internship program. Before Youth Skills Training Program funding, we did not offer any elective credits for paid industry career pathway internships for our students. We've been doing this for the last 3 years. Through this funding, and we had over 70 juniors and seniors this year that had taken a related CTE course and are now earning additional credits while learning in paid internships. They learn so much more beyond just the technical skills while they're at those jobs. They're gaining employability skills, they're learning about new career opportunities, they're identifying new mentors, they're providing guidance on further education options, so it's not four-year college for all, but really what's in their best interest, along with often receiving funding to pay for training. I had a student once that was in an internship tell me that he's going to be ahead of everybody else when he graduates as an engineer because he has real experience in the field because of his high school internship. The next thing I wanted to focus on was the increased partnerships. Our advisory committees within our district have grown and really helped us align our curriculum with industry changes and standards. We have employers that are volunteering in our classrooms, donating supplies, and opening their doors for tours, job shadowing, and more because of this partnership. Lastly, the third benefit is really addressing workforce shortages. A great example is a student named Kellen. He graduated last year from high school, but when he was a junior, Kellen consistently was vocalizing his displeasure with school to his parents. And it's because of the way he learns. He thrives when he works hands-on and is able to think critically. He was a leader in his robotics team. He also really enjoyed his engineering and manufacturing class. So we were able to use this program as a 16-year-old to place him in an internship at a local company called Metalcraft in manufacturing. Kellen's father said being in the internship program was a blessing for him. He was excited to learn new skills and took great pride. He saw his maturity grow and also saw that he was genuinely excited to go to work. We actually had to rein Kellen back a little bit because he was actually working too much, but we were able to use that as leverage for him to keep up his schoolwork and get good grades and graduate on time. He is now still actually working for Metalcraft, and he is actually in a lead position mentoring our new high school students as they come in. So really developing that workforce pipeline and also really recruiting young population into the industry. So in conclusion, I am just grateful for the funding our school district has received and want to support additional funding for youth skills training program in this bill, as it will create new partnerships across the state and prepare many more young people for the workforce. Again, thank you for your time and including the youth skills training funding in this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Lord. Next up, we have Dr. Barbara Doyle with Urban League Twin Cities.
Good afternoon, Chairman Eklund and committee members. My name is Dr. Barbara Doyle. I'm the Director of Workforce for the Urban League Twin Cities. This was formerly the Minneapolis Urban League. Now we serve the entire Twin City area. I come this afternoon to say thank you. We appreciate the leadership you have exhibited through your support and commitment to include the funding for the LEAP program. Without additional funding for this vital program, we are not able to help many people within the community who come to the Urban League wanting an opportunity as a registered apprentice. Many times when we talk about our community, we do not speak about the individuals who make up our community and how each one of those individual lives are impacted through the funded community programs that are available. Now, because of the shortness of time, I want to highlight two such individuals who have been impacted by the very program for which we need additional financial support. One individual is Derek, who came to us last year in 2021 with a dream of making a living, of becoming a carpenter. And now, just a year later, he is actually living out that dream. Because of the program you are supporting, he now has learned the skill of carpentry. He served as an apprentice and is now making a livable wage of over $70,000 this year. This is incredible. This has been a life changer for Derek. Another individual is Julian, who unfortunately made a series of choices when he was younger that landed him in prison. But once released from prison, he had little hope of what his future now holds. But hope comes in opportunity. You see, Julian found a lifeline through the LEAP program. This was the exact opportunity he needed. He has now been able to literally turn his life around. The LEAP program has been the lifeline that has given him something to hold on to and be able to thrive. He is now able to support himself and his family. And in Julian's own words, and I quote, "The LEAP program is a game changer, and this program and job have changed my life for my family and me." So, Chairman Eklund and committee, these are only two examples of many who have benefited from this program. And through your continuous support of increasing the funding for the LEAP program, we will have many more testimonials. As I stated earlier, the community is made up of individuals, and through the increased funding of this program, we will help to transform more individual lives. And those individuals will in turn help to further evolve and transform our community. So on behalf of the participants who have benefited and the future participants who will benefit from increased funding, we thank you for your continued support and commitment to this invaluable program. I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you on our shared service and commitment to our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Doyle. Next up, we have Evan Starr.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me okay?
Sure. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chairman Eklund and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Evan Starr, and I'm an economist and associate professor at the University of Maryland's Robert H. Smith School of Business. And today, I'd like to highlight my support for Section 10 and 11 of House File 4177, which are the sections on non-compete agreements and franchise no-poach agreements. Over the last decade, I've been studying the use and impacts of contractual restraints on employee mobility and the effects of various approaches to regulating them. I've published more than a dozen articles about non-competes and other restrictive covenants, and I've testified on these issues in front of the U.S. Senate, the U.S. House of Representatives, and the Federal Trade Commission. The research supports regulating non-competes and no-poach agreements in ways addressed by this bill. And today I briefly want to summarize this research so that you understand what the state of the art is here. The first question is, how common are restrictions like non-competes and no-poach agreements? Well, nationally, non-compete agreements cover between 15 and 28% of U.S. workers, and we know that 30% of firms use non-competes for all workers within the firm without regard to job title, duties, or compensation. With regard to franchise no-poach agreements, we learned in 2016 that 60% of major franchises included these agreements in their franchise contracts, and they stipulated that a franchisee could not poach workers from another franchisee within the same firm. Second, while workers do not have the opportunity to agree to no-poach agreements because they are organizational labor contracts, and so they can't be compensated for signing one, in principle, workers could negotiate over non-competes. But only 10% of non-compete workers actually report negotiating over these contracts, and employers regularly compel workers to sign non-competes when the worker has limited bargaining power, like on the first day of the job. Perhaps most importantly, most research suggests that non-compete agreements and no-poach agreements reduce employee mobility and wages, making it harder for firms to hire the workers who may be best suited to fill open jobs. Importantly, the research on non-competes finds that the wage and mobility declines also spill over to those not bound by non-competes and into neighboring labor markets. They clog up the whole labor market, not just affecting the workers who are bound by them. Fourth, while there are justifications for some of these types of restrictions, as it relates to no-poach agreements, there are other tools to protect those interests without going over the worker's head. A similar point is also true for non-competes. Other tools like NDAs, trade secret laws, trainee repayment agreements, etc., can do similar jobs for the firm without constraining worker options so severely. I'd also like to address three common concerns that I often hear related to bills like this. One natural concern is that small firms will be unfairly hurt if workers can walk across the street and compete. The evidence suggests that this concern is unfounded. The research suggests that not only does enforcing non-compete agreements prevent new firms from starting in the first place, it also prevents them from growing and disadvantages them relative to larger incumbents, in part because it makes it really difficult to hire. A second concern related to the non-compete bill is what the right earnings threshold is and whether the median income for a family of four is too high or too low. States have taken varying approaches here, including the median income for a family of four. And some of my preliminary research suggests that thresholds up to and exceeding $100,000 a year are in fact very reasonable. A final concern is, of course, that regulating non-competes is a partisan issue. And I just want to highlight that without a doubt, this is untrue. Joining California as the only states where non-competes are outright unenforceable are Oklahoma and North Dakota. And right now there is legislation moving forward to ban low-wage non-competes in Iowa and West Virginia, as well as in many other states. I thank you for the chance to be here to talk about this today, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Stern. Next up we have Megan Hennen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Megan Hennen with the Associated Builders and Contractors. I would first like to take the opportunity to say we appreciate the work on the elevator licensing language change. The language for consideration in the A3 amendment upholds the integrity of licensing in the state, while at the same time allowing some common sense flexibility in the work that can be performed without jeopardizing health or public safety. That being said, we do have a number of concerns with the language being considered before the committee. Our commercial and industrial contractor members and the men and women they employ are part of the 73% of the construction industry in Minnesota that choose to be merit shop craft professionals rather than be in a union. Several of our members help build, maintain, and repair Minnesota's refineries covered under this sweeping legislation we see in Article 7. Our members have customized in-house safety programs, craft training, and more, even though they are not registered with the state. They take pride in their work, and even more so, the safety record for each and every employee. The language in Article 7 would, for the first time in Minnesota, mandate registered apprenticeship programs on wholly private construction projects. This bill will have a discriminatory impact against qualified local contractors and the qualified local men and women they employ. If you're a part of the 73% of Minnesota's construction workforce who are not in a union, the odds are you are not in a registered apprenticeship program and would therefore be essentially prohibited right out of the gates from working on projects covered in this language. The absence of a registered apprenticeship program has nothing to do with a contractor's ability to perform work, their work product, or the ability to perform that work safely. We have also heard the claim a number of times that this is about safety and quality. However, if that was truly the case, why are union business agents and recruiters spending countless time and energy trying to recruit our merit shop members and their workers into their ranks? ABC thinks all qualified licensed contractors and their craft professionals should be allowed to bid and work here. We would strongly encourage this committee to reconsider this new unprecedented and discriminatory mandate. And we would also encourage that the committee reconsider the stricken language on line 6.13 regarding the grant for labor education advancement. We do not oppose promoting careers in construction. ABC and our members are doing that every day. But what we are opposing is the intentional exclusion of the majority of the construction industry. The decision to remove the language for apprenticeable trades and occupations and replace it with registered apprenticeship programs further narrows the opportunities for students. Being that the majority of construction workforce are not in registered apprenticeship programs, this language greatly limits the options for the recipients of this grant and would seem to be the very opposite of the proposal's intent. If there is a shortage of registered apprentices, especially among women, BIPOC community members, and veterans, the solution is not more taxpayer dollars. The solution is to be competitive and offer wages and benefits that attract these communities. And if the state is looking to bolster the construction industry and workforce, it should look to do so for all construction pathways. Thank you for your time, members, and Mr. Chair, I will stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hennen. We'll open it up for questions and comments to the from the testifiers. I'm going to remind the committee that we don't want to bump up against the clock too hard. So keep your questions concise and answers concise as well, please. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my first question is for the Commissioner Abdali, Mrs. Robertson. And we passed some legislation a few years back with funding for helmets to hard hats. Do you recall that bill and how much money is going into that program to recruit people in the military for good paying jobs in the workforce?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, I don't have that information right with me, but I am definitely very familiar with helmets to hard hat. I do have a number of my staff that is online, and I also have my assistant commissioner here with me. I simply don't have the reference document here.
Mr. Chair?
One second, Representative Detmer. We have an answer coming to the floor.
Okay.
Please identify yourself and go ahead and answer the questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kate Prushek. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Department of Labor and Industry. I believe Helmets to Hard Hats received a $225,000 appropriation last session, but House fiscal staff may know with certainty what that number is.
Is fiscal staff available to answer that question?
Mr. Chair, this is Helen Roberts from the House fiscal staff. I would also have to look that up since the labor provisions were moved to a different conference committee than I normally staff, but I can look it up quickly.
If you do so in the next 20 minutes, that'd be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, I know there's two FTEs that were hired for that program, and it's a good program for veterans, but my question is on line 1.7, line 1.7, is that basically, you know, working the same thing as helmets to hard hats? That would be my question, because it looks like it's you're dealing with the trades for veterans, salary and benefits. You're starting at $200,000 in 23, $150,000, and then $180,000, and then $160,000. So the funding is going down. I see that. But also, is helmets to hard hats, is that an ongoing funding? That would be another question that I would have. Is it ongoing? And would we need this funding on top of helmets to hard hats?
Okay. Commissioners?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Robertson.
Representative Detmer. We believe that in these transformative times, any effort that we can put forth to support our military to transfer from service to civilian and secure an ongoing livable wage to support their families are wise investments on behalf of the state. Helmets to Hard Hat is a flow-through grant program for the Department of Labor and Industry. That money just passed through the agency. The purpose of this initiative is to ensure that those individuals that work directly with the registered apprenticeship programs are available to provide direct support to veterans that are interested in that program. The Helmets to Hard Hats program basically help veterans move from service to civilian, and it moves them into the construction trades. This provision, although construction is the dominant registered apprenticeship program, would not limit the veterans to entering into just construction. It will be there to ensure that those individuals that are most knowledgeable about registered apprenticeship could help engage, direct, and assist veterans moving into not just construction but other programs and allow them to utilize their benefits as they are in the training program. It will further support them to ensure that the veterans are earning a livable wage by accessing the benefits while they are in the training program. So back to your question, is it needed? Considering that currently we have more job openings than we have individuals to fill those jobs, we're going to have to be as creative as possible to ensure that we have the skilled workers to backfill those critical positions as individuals continue to retire, continue to resign. So I believe it is a good investment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer, we have House Research on tap here. Ms. Anna Shaleen can help us out with the question.
Chair and members, I staff the Workforce Omnibus, where the Helmets to Hard Hats language ended up last year. And in the 2021 Omnibus, Helmets to Hard Hats received $225,000 each year from the Workforce Development Fund as one-time funding.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further, Representative Detmer?
Yeah, I do have another question. This is for the boxing referee, Mark Nelson.
Yes.
Thanks. I'll skip over one of the questions.
So. Don't start a fight.
I'll just wrestle.
Welcome back. Mr. Nelson,
yeah,
welcome
you.
Back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, you are part of a good program, and what is your policy, your organizational policy regarding transgender with the boxing?
Right now, that's a question I can't answer. I don't know.
Okay. That,
care to explore that any
further? Well, I think it's a safety issue. I think it's something that we should address as a committee. I know that there's a big difference in men and women, regardless of gender. And I know if all of us, I know many of us have daughters, and would you like to step in the ring with under this situation? So that's something you should probably check into, because it is becoming a national issue, and I think as a state, we need to address that. And so thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Next up, question from Representative Raleigh, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll bring it forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this one, the first one goes to the author. I want to take a look at 12.32. It's the smoke detection devices. And through the chair to the author, in our public safety committees, we've been hearing testimony and we're looking at language changes. And everywhere that there is a reference to a smoke detector, the language has been changed to smoke alarm. And so through the chair again, just to the author, would you be interested in changing that to smoke detector to be in compliance? Because we're hearing a lot of testimony in other committees that it no longer should be alarm.
Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Raleigh, we certainly can take a look at that. If you notice, this isn't underlined or stricken or anything, so right. it's old statute. So we can take a look at that and possibly at ways and means, if need be, amend it that way.
Okay. Anything further, Representative Raleigh?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Next one is to Commissioner Robertson. Commissioner Robertson, Article 2, Section 14, page 11.15. You had stated that, because you'd pointed out in the bill that we're looking to achieve net zero by 2036, which is 14 years from now. And I'm wondering what the cost is going to be to Minnesota to implement net zero by 2036, if we know what the total cost of this is going to be according to this bill.
Commissioner Robertson, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do have the Director of the Construction Code and Licensing Division on the line, and maybe he could assist us here.
Mr. McClellan, please identify yourself for the record and help us out.
Yep. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Scott McClellan. I'm the Director of Construction Codes and Licensing for the Department of Labor and Industry. The way this bill is structured is to give the department the charge to, as we're adopting the National Energy Code every 3 years, as required by the federal government, this would require us to incorporate, and to ensure, I should say, that it's at least 8% efficient over its preceding edition of the code. So in some given years, the national standard may be, the last two editions have been around 7%. And so in order to hit the target of net zero by 2036, we're introducing this 8% to make sure we can ensure that. The cost to new buildings won't be discovered until actually rulemaking occurs to see, one, what are the new improvements in the national ASHRAE standard, and two, what additional work must the agency do to get it to 8%. And that's part of the funding request, is to get a market analysis and cost analysis in that rulemaking process to be able to identify what the specific costs before each individual addition would make it through the rulemaking process.
Any follow-up, Representative Raleigh?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the follow-up would be, if we were able to reduce the greenhouse gases through the construction part of this bill, what will be the global impact on greenhouse gases globally if Minnesota were to reduce it in the construction side to zero? So I can restate it if needed, Mr. Chair.
Mr. McClellan, are you clear on that?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I don't have that information. That is something we could research for you, but we're addressing it from the standpoint of the state of Minnesota, and I don't know the global impact, but we could look into it for you, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's exactly the point that I'm trying to explore here, is if we're looking at a global standard of global climate change, because climate is a global thing, it's not a regional, it's not like the weather. What I want to know is how much we're going to spend on this bill with all the other bills that we're looking at in total, and what the percentage of the Minnesota impact is going to be, and then compare that along with the other 50 states for the United States, and then we would be able to have a standard that we'd be able to look at for the global issue that we're looking at for climate change, because we're looking at individual pieces of this in the bills, but I think we need to start thinking about more of a global impact, and then take a look at the cost per percentage of reduction as we look towards a zero impact. And what I worry about, Mr. Chair, is some of these sound like really good ideas, but the follow-on costs and the impacts on our environment and on our everything else that goes into it. For example, it's a great idea to go to electric generation with wind power. The follow-on costs of that are a reduction locally of the environmental impact on that area. But globally, we have to take a look at the sum total of the impact of mining those minerals in China or Russia or other areas. And over 70% of all these rare earth minerals are being mined elsewhere, and they have less environmental safeguards than we have here in Minnesota, Mr. Chair. So that's really what I worry about on that side. It's my last point, Mr. Chair. We're looking at this bill, and we're seeing that, we know that workplace safety is important to all employers and to all employees, workers at every single level. And with the pandemic and the extremely damaging shutdowns of the Walls Biden administration, we've seen the impact that's had on our job creators. So the penalties that are in this bill seem to be onerous and contentious, and I'm feeling they're creating an unnecessary tension between the workers and the job creators. So I'd like to, as we get into shaping this bill and through the conference committees and everything else, we should be looking at regulations that help the various industries and are seen as working collaboratively, as opposed to increasing penalties and creating this tension, Mr. Chair. And so I would encourage all of us to work in a bipartisan way to not just look at penalizing the job creators, but also working to make sure that we understand how these things are being done and how we can better serve the people of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for that message. Representative Bliss, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Raleigh covered most of what I was going to cover, but I do want to go back to something that was said from the gentleman. I didn't catch his name that was on the screen there, that the cost of this program, the net zero, isn't going to be figured out till rulemaking, but we have it built into statute that it has to be decreased by 8% a year. So if we have it built into statute, we're not going to figure out the cost till rulemaking. That's kind of baked into the process right now, so it's going to increase the cost of these buildings. And you know, one thing the commissioner said was that this is not just commercial office space, but it's also multifamily housing. And I sit on the housing committee, and that's a huge issue right now, is the affordability of rental properties. And by doing this, and you're increasing the cost to build these buildings every year, and snowballing it by increasing it by 8% every, what is it, 6 years? It's only going to exacerbate the problem of the affordable housing that we have right now. And I guess, you know, that this goes back to everything that we're seeing in these bills, is that we have all these grand plans, and we're going to impact our job creators this way. We're going to impact our housing providers this way. And the overall cost to these providers and job creators isn't figured out. I mean, we don't know what it is. When I asked the question, when the commissioner was going over her budget, the $1.78 million was for FTEs for her department. There was no description of what it was going to cost the industries for the mandates that were going on them. So that's my concern, that we need to address that in the future, that any mandate we put on a business or housing providers or anything like that, the costs have to be figured in so we know what we're looking at when we do the legislation. So that's really all I have. Again, most of it was just a repeat of what Representative Raleigh had.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Next up on the list, we have Representative Greenman.
I can go. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to say, as we're talking about this bill, I think this is a really good bill because it reflects the testimony we've heard actually in the last 2 years. When we look at we've been talking a lot about OSHA and OSHA compliance, and I think what this bill does as it relates to conformity is it requires that our provisions are in line with federal and then OSHA, which means that we can continue to operate the Minnesota OSHA, which I think, as we've heard and we've talked about in the context of other bills, is something that we want to do. We don't want federal OSHA to come in because we're not in compliance. I also just wanted to lift up, I think, some of the testimony we heard today, but that we've heard in the last couple of this session and last session from meatpackers, from refinery workers, from folks who have been asking us to address specific safety issues in their industries. And I think that this bill does a good job of that, both with the protection of agricultural workers and food processing workers, as well as with the Refinery Safety Act, which I know last year we had a lot of conversations in the House and the Senate, and there was bipartisan support for it. It is an important piece of policy for really dangerous jobs we're talking about. And so when we think about the work that we're doing together, when we think about the folks who are supporting on this, both the workers and also the communities, when we talk about community public safety, I just wanted to say, because I think I'm really glad we have these provisions in this omnibus, and I really hope that we can work together. I know we passed the Refinery Safety Act off the floor, and it had bipartisan support in both the Senate and the House. But one thing I think is really important is that it had bipartisan support from the members who represented the districts that have these refineries in their community. And that's about the safety of workers, but it's also about the safety of communities. And I believe that both in the House and the Senate, all of those members who represented those areas, the two big refineries in Minnesota, supported this bill because they really saw that. So I hope as we're moving forward, we're really thinking about those folks, those communities, those workers, and what we can do for them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm going to remind people to be concise with their comments here. Representative Edelson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to comment in terms of the franchise piece. I really like that. I think that's important. As somebody that's very pro-business, has lots of friends that own businesses, I think there's also a balance that we have to take that's pro-worker. I just want to say with the combat sports, I just am curious if that guy could tell us, that testifier could tell us what states he modeled it after.
Nelson.
Oh, yes, thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. Nelson?
Oh, I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
I just wanted, Mr. Chair,
I want the microphone, please.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, I was hoping he could let us know what states this was modeled after.
Various states. Matt Showalter, our director of Minnesota Combatant Sports, did the research, but I know states like Nevada, New York, other states where big promoters are doing events, they have similar physicals for boxers. A girl recently tested positive, or she was pregnant, and the way she found out was she weighed in, and they required pregnancy tests, and she said, no, I'm not. They gave her two tests, and then she went to the clinic. Well, she couldn't box the next day. That's how she found out. But a lot of states have these type of regular physicals.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I could just one more thing. I just wanted to...
Representative Edelson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know it was brought up, you know, what if a transgender person was playing, but I mean, we're talking about combat, tough person contest. I think if you're going to be involved with that, I think you're going to be okay.
Thank you. Representative Berg, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say a couple of words about the registered apprenticeship program part of the bill. I don't think we need to leave hanging in the room the argument from the ABC that somehow we're holding workers hostage if they go through an accredited program. People have the choice whether they want to leave after they've graduated from their program and go to a merit-based shop. But the fact is these programs teach workers how to have the utmost safety on their jobs and how they are going to be leaders in the skill that they're being trained for. So I think it does a disservice to the portion of this bill as well as the programs that are established to suggest that the unions are somehow leaving workers out if they choose not to join the union. That's not the case. So let's lift up our workers and our safety standards. And I really appreciate the chair putting that into the bill. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Poston, please.
Thank you, Chair Sundin. I'd like to talk about the non-compete portion of the bill just real briefly. I don't have a question, just more of a statement. I think the language hurts small businesses. You know, I think typically people think about non-competes and they think about confidential information and customer lists and those sorts of things. Well, I operate a small business. I don't normally like to talk about it, but we operate 5 restaurants and a catering company in the Brainerd Lakes area. And we are going through right now what we go through every year. We hire chefs, we train chefs, we teach them our menus, we give them good pay, we give them good benefits, and at this time every year when our big resorts get ready to open, guess what happens? The big resorts that hire people for 4 or 5 months come around and pay them $3 or $4 more an hour because they can and because they only employ them for like 4 or 5 months. We employ them for 12 months out of the year. We give them very good pay. We give them very good benefits. We give them very good training. They see all of our menus. They know everything that we do in our catering business. They know all of our contacts, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we use non-competes and we use contracts, you know, for that reason. But we go through this every year. And this is kind of unique to the hospitality industry up in my neck of the woods. They're not leaving because we don't take good care of them. We do, but these big guys can come around and offer $4 or $5 more an hour for 4 or 5 months with no benefits and take those people. And any of you that work in the hospitality business know exactly what I'm talking about. So this non-compete language hurt small businesses greatly. Thank you,
Thanks
Mr. Chair.
Thanks for making your points. I've just been informed we've got the room for an extra 15 minutes. If we can finish in the next 20 minutes, we're going to be fine. Either that or we're going to have to be back at 8:30 tonight. So if we can move along, I understand Representative McDonald has comments.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of my colleagues brought up some very good points about why we think that this particular bill will do some harm to our business and job creators in Minnesota. There's some good provisions. We certainly acknowledge that. But between the non-compete, increased building cost, and the red tape and regulations, it will indeed do some harm to our businesses. We are not quite done with the pandemic and this economic recovery that we're trying to get through after the disastrous walls shutdown, policies that greatly harmed small businesses in Minnesota. The legislature should be working to cooperatively for our job creators and deliver a do-no-harm approach. But instead, this bill does that. It does harm with cost burdens, mandates, operational restrictions, employees who are doing their best to keep their doors open, and Minnesotans keep Minnesotans employed. Yet this bill and Democrats continue to do the opposite, almost sticking a thumb in the eye, if you will, to job creators. Minnesota is already considered one of the high-cost state of doing business. Employers currently must adhere to strict set of labor laws and workplace standards at all levels of government in order to maintain safe and healthy mandates and respectful, inclusive workplace. The cost of compliance and operational impacts of workplace mandates, increased regulations and fines, and operational restrictions, such as the ones that are being introduced in this bill, put pressure on employees, particularly small employees and small businesses, specifically in Article 2, prohibiting non-compete agreements, and Article 3, increasing OSHA penalties and fines, and Article 4 and 8, making various modifications and additions to labor standards for agriculture and food processing workers. We believe those provisions will do great harm to our business and job creators. Therefore, we are opposed to the bill as it stands. We hope that the Senate certainly will, in conference committee, will come together and take some of the provisions that will do harm to our job creators. We received a letter from NFIB, which my business and many of my businesses and family businesses in Wright County are members. They have over 75,000 business members throughout all corners of the state, and they are opposed to this bill because it frankly will do no good for their businesses. Almost all of their business members have less than 75 employees each. Those are small businesses. And frankly, I'm sorry to say that, Mr. Chair, this bill will not do any good to help them recover from the last 2 years of economic pandemic and shutdown hardships. We're going through some high inflation costs, 40-year high inflation, record gas prices. We just simply can't afford this bill, which will do more harm to businesses in Minnesota. So for those reasons, I do not support your bill.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. Any final words on the A22-04-02? Chair Eklund, any further comments?
No, Mr. Chair, right now I'd like to move the D1-22-402. I don't think we moved it yet, so I'd like to do that, and I don't have any further comments. I'll reserve my comments till the end.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, Chair Eklund did move it earlier, but, you know, one for a good measure. I appreciate that.
Okay, no further discussion time available. All those in favor of adopting the DE1A22-0402, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Okay. Motion carries. The amendment is adopted. Members, next we're going to move on to the A1 author's amendment. Chair Eklund, please move and explain your amendment.
I'll move the A1 author's amendment, H4177A1, Mr. Chair. And what this does, it takes $200,000 in fiscal year 23 to create a veterans liaison coordinator at the Department of Labor and Industry. And then it adds the agriculture workers worker wellness provision that's in the bill. And that's what the A1 amendment does, Mr. Chair.
Any questions to the author?
Chair Eklund, final comment? Oh, excuse me. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Chair Eklund, that money, does it go to the veterans or is it paid by for one who's in charge of that program?
Chair Eklund. Mr. Chair, that'll create a coordinator for veterans liaison work within the Department of Labor and Industry. And you mentioned helmets and hard hats earlier. That's one of the programs that this person will oversee rather than assigning part-time staff to monitor these programs.
Follow-up, Representative Detmer?
Yeah, just a quick one, Mr. Chair. And so now we have two FTEs for the helmets to hard hats, plus now one more FTE for the Dolly. So that's what we're looking at is three FTEs. Am I correct?
Representative, Chair Eklund. Mr. Chair, this one is creating one new FTE. I don't recall what we did last year with helmets to hard hats on the FTEs, Representative Detmer. So
yeah, there's two.
Follow-up.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Yeah, there is two FTEs for helmets and hard hats.
Thank you. Okay, any other comments? Okay, all those in favor adopting the A1 author's amendment to House File 4177 as amended, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say nay. That motion carries. The amendment is adopted. Members, next we have A3 amendment from Chair Nelson. Chair Nelson, please move and explain your amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A3 amendment, and as Commissioner Robertson spoke about, this is dealing with, there was some dispute about conveyors and elevators, and it kind of overlapped a couple different trades and a couple parts of the statute, and this is just cleaning that up, and there's agreement from all the parties. I introduced this bill early last year, and the party's been working on it since last year. We thought we had an agreement last week, and then another problem came up, and they worked that out. And that's what this amendment does here. It just clarifies those positions about elevators and conveyor belts and those type of material handling pieces. So that's what the amendment does, and it adds that into the bill, as Commissioner Robertson talked about.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Any questions or comments from the members on this? Chair Nelson, any final comments on the A3?
It's a good amendment, ma'am, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. All those in favor adopting the A3 author's amendment to House File 4177 as amended, please say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. Okay, that motion carries and the amendment is adopted. There's seeing no more amendments, we're back to the bill as amended. Any further comments from members on the bill? Okay. Chair Eklund, any final comments for the committee? Would you care to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll renew my motion that House File 4177 as amended be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Members, I brought some cookies to try to sweeten you up a little bit before we did.
They're all gone.
Mr. Kennedy said he had three, so that's good. But no, first off, I want to say it's really good to be back in a hearing room. And we will be here tomorrow for the veterans portion of this bill. But this bill, some interesting comments came up. You can call it climate change. You can call it whatever you want. It's happening. So we need to address it. There needs to be measures in these bills to address climate change because it's going on. Some of these aren't new provisions. There's a program that I worked with Commissioner Robertson 20 years ago, 25 years ago maybe, up at the paper mill that I retired from, was called MinStar, where if a company and the unions got together, they could work with Department of Labor and Industry and come up with programs that work to keep you in OSHA compliance without causing the fines and things that we're talking about. That's what happens when we're in federal compliance. If Minnesota doesn't comply with our OSHA compliant regulations, then it'll go back to a national program, and we won't have that flexibility. When there's a problem at an industry, they will automatically be fined to the maximum amount. Right now, if there's a problem at the industry, the commissioner's staff can work with that industry. There may be a fine, it may be at a lesser amount, but they can figure out what the problem with that is. If we don't comply federally, then we will lose that flexibility. So there's some misconception there. And this isn't the Biden-Walz administration. This is the Wallace-Flanagan administration. The Biden administration's out in D.C., and I might want to let you know, last month, we created 450,000 new jobs. We have a federal unemployment rate at about 3.7%. Minnesota's unemployment rate is lower than that. We have a worker issue, but the economy is moving. It's moving right along. If it wasn't, we wouldn't be at 3.7% or creating 450,000 jobs a year. So anyway, members, this is a good bill. I know my good friends on the other side of the aisle don't like it, but I ask you to vote green.
Okay, Mr. Petrie, would you please take the roll on the bill?
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Chair Eklund, yes. Representative Zhang.
Yes.
Representative Zhang, yes. Representative Detmer.
No.
Representative Detmer, no. Representative McDonald.
No.
Representative McDonald, no. Representative Berg.
Yes.
Representative Berg, yes. Representative Bliss.
No.
Representative Bliss, no. Representative Edelson.
Yes.
Representative Edelson, yes. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Representative Frederick, aye. Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Greenman, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Nelson, aye. Representative Poston.
No.
Representative Poston, no. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, nay.
Representative Raleigh, nay. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Representative Sundin, aye. And Mr. Chair, we have 8 ayes and 5 nays.
By a vote of 8 ayes and 5 nays, House File 4177, as amended, is on its way to the Ways and Means Committee. Nonpartisan committee staff is authorized to make any technical changes necessary to reflect the will of the committee. Any further questions or comments from members? Seeing none, our next committee meeting will be Wednesday, April 6th, right here. We will be going through the omnibus bill for veterans and military affairs. We are adjourned. Thank you.